It is my great pleasure to introduce Yasho Bodhi, whose name means, I'm not sure I caught it all exactly, but something like, she who has the wisdom that leads to enlightenment. So, listen up! And we spoke, you know, our names, when we enter the order, our names are given to us. We don't choose them. So her preceptor, who is a lovely woman, named Akasha Shuri, chose this name for Yasho Bodhi. Our names reflect qualities that we already embody to a certain extent and give us something to aspire to, something to work towards. So when you meet order members, you can bear that in mind.
We're not
says the giver of truth. Yasho Bodhi comes to us from London. She's connected to the West London Buddhist Center, where she is Mitra convener for the women mitras there. But she's not a native to England. She originally comes from Holland, the Netherlands, and you'll hear something quite European and lovely in her accent. Yasho Bodhi has many wonderful qualities. There's a brightness and a very positive energy that comes from Yasho Bodhi, and this something I really appreciate, and I think she and I exchange when we can, is a really intelligent approach to practice. So, welcome, Yasho Bodhi.
Thank you. Yeah, I sometimes really think that it's, I said that yesterday as well, it's just kind of going to go downhill after you've had such a fabulous introduction.
Let's try not to do that.
So yesterday I gave a talk also called Who Wants to Become a Bodhisattva in the Portsmouth Buddhist Center. And there's just one person, or two persons actually, here, where they are yesterday, so you might hear a few repeats, but I hope you'll forgive me. Okay, so the title, Who Wants to Become a Bodhisattva? And this is really a personal story about my aspiration towards bodhisattvahood and some of the issues I've been grappling with in the course of the years since I first got to know this this Buddhist concept. And some of the pitfalls, yeah, the pitfalls for me at least, for instance, prematurely wanting to engage in bodhisattva activity, or the danger of perfectionism, and this mistake that you always have to be active and have to do something, always striving, working towards self-improvement. So that's the kind of, that's some of the pitfalls that you can fall into on this aspiring path. And I was also going to try to define the word bodhicitta. Some of you might not know, some of you might know. Anybody who doesn't know the word bodhicitta? I've got a few sort of slight shakes there. That's good. That's just a bit of an idea for me to see. And I also go into, hopefully, why bodhicitta is a secret ingredient that turns lead into gold. So that's one. And it's been really interesting for me to do this talk, actually, because I started working on it whilst I was still at home in London, and I really noticed how sometimes I really could not connect to the topic at all, and I just thought, what is this about? I haven't got a clue what this is about. And then I had to reconnect again with my heart and to find my inspiration and to understand it. So for me, it was a real illustration of my journey in terms of first understanding what it means, what bodhisattva means, and then starting to kind of have much more emotional connection to it. And so this, I went through all the time, actually, whilst I was preparing this talk, like first sort of looking at the words, thinking, I haven't got a clue what this means, and then kind of connecting to it. And I think that is a bit like the journey that we're on, really, just learning these Dharma concepts and then understanding them more deeply and taking more deeply. And so they sort of become part of us. Anyway, that's my introduction. So let's see how far I get. Yesterday I had no way time to do everything that I had to adjust. So let's see how far I get. Back for part two, yeah. So when I first heard about this word bodhisattva, it was a definition that was similar to a definition I found when I was visiting the Boston Museum of Fine Arts a few days ago, or last week. Thursday I was there with Sunada. And you know, you've got these descriptions, they've got this, such a beautiful collection of books, really amazing. So one of those descriptions, what it means to be a bodhisattva, because there's lots of these statues of bodhisattvas there, is a bodhisattva, enlightened being, has reached Buddhahood, but remains on earth to help all beings gain enlightenment. Yeah, I'll repeat that for the people at the back. A bodhisattva, enlightened being, has reached Buddhahood, but remains on earth to help all beings gain enlightenment. Now, this sounded extremely abstract to me. I really think that it was just words. It was just, you know, it was a nice idea somehow, but it is more like a myth, and I just, yeah, it was interesting, but I didn't connect to it, basically. I really did not connect to it. So, well, one of the things that I think that I didn't really connect to it is because I was using my literal mind. I was actually thinking, all beings on earth reaching enlightenment and me helping them out, that's not going to be possible at all. So I was just, you know, just really did not get it, to be honest. I really didn't get it. But so the first few years that I was practicing Buddhism, this bodhisattva thing was very much an abstract thing, a concept. And it started to become alive after I'd been practicing for about 4 years or so. And I'll tell you a bit about how that happened, that process. So I had, this is a year that I'd asked for ordination, and I'd been on a pilgrimage in India, and I'd spent a couple of months in the UK, trying to understand a bit more what this Triratna thing that we're doing is all about. And after I came back from this pilgrimage, I went to a talk about the bodhisattva ideal. So, but I first have to tell you a bit about what happened when I was in Nepal. In Nepal, I stayed in a hostel, and in the hostel next to it, it was a place called Pokhara, when you're doing the Annapurna track. I don't know, some of you might have done that. But, so there's this place at the foot of the Himalayas, and it's called Pokhara. And there was this hostel, and in this hostel, there were a lot of beautiful and lovely young women. And I heard their story, and I was totally shocked about this story. Because what was the story? These women had been, from their families, their mountain kind of tribal environment, villages, been sold off to the Bombay brothels. And in the Bombay brothels in India, it's this idea that if you are infected with HIV, that you can cure yourself by having sex with a virgin. So these Nepali young girls had been sent to Bombay and then contracted the virus themselves, were expelled, were sent back to Nepal. And in Nepal, nobody wanted to know them anymore because their families didn't want to know them anymore. They were kind of contaminated. So this hostel next to the hostel I was staying, that's where they were. That's where some of these women were. And I was just so, I was just really, really moved by that story and really sad about it. So I went to this talk, and this talk was by a Dutch professor and a Zen master. And he was talking about a bodhisattva that's called Shitigarbha. Some of you might have known him. In Japan, he's called Jizo. And Shitigarbha goes into the underworld, and he saves beings, and he takes them all with them. He just saves beings there. And this professor, in his talk, was also talking about a Dutch organization that was active in the developing countries to work with, to try to go against the sexual abuse of children by Western jurists in the developing countries, which is like a massive, massive problem still. So countries like Malaysia, there was just an article in the Guardian the other day about somebody who's been convicted of uncountable crimes in that area, and it's of Thailand and Philippines, you name it. So this talk moved me so much, the Chitigarba and the pews, etc., that I was just an hour after that talk, I was just still walking about like in a daze, and there were just tears streaming down my face. I was just so deeply moved by his talk. And so that's, I think, is the moment that the Bodhisattva ideal really started to become alive for me. So I wrote an email to a friend of mine a bit later, maybe that week that I'd been to this talk, and I found out on my computer, I just typed in, when did I use the word Bodhisattva first in my emails, and that was that particular email. So I translated it was in Dutch originally. So she was actually, this friend was a bit worried about me because she felt I was sort of getting a bit too Bodhisattva-like. Too idealistic. So I wrote to her as a reply to her being worried about me. So I said, yes, the Bodhisattva ideal has become very important to me in the last couple of months. Or I could say that I'm deeply moved by the thought that other beings are suffering, and I would like to contribute to reducing that. And that is only possible by pouring my entire being into becoming a bigger person who has more to offer to others. And this I feel on a very deep level in my being, and the energy to want to do this feels passionate. And the decision to want to achieve this is the most important thing about being a human at this point. And this touches me very deeply and moves me to tears whilst I'm typing this. It has become a big passion. So somehow all of that, my life, what I encountered, and the talk, all of that accumulated into this sort of whatever, the seed being touched in me of wanting to do this. So, well, that's where I was. And what did I do next? You already know. So what I did next is actually I went to work for the Hotline Combating Child Pornography on the internet in Holland, which is basically, child pornography is basically evidence of child abuse. And the first day I was at work, I was found myself after a few hours sitting in the toilet. Mm. And I just thought, I just don't think I can do this. I don't think I can do this. But I did, and I continued to do this for about 14 months. And became really desperately unhappy in the process. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'm meditating, I'm guarding the senses, I didn't know what to do, I worked with the ethics, I worked with the precepts. But it was just awful. It was just really awful. And so I just had to stop doing it. And I think this was just, for me, an example of how I had this strong idea, which is, I think, it's in, I mean, that's totally genuine, but I was not realistic enough about my own capacity and capabilities to start doing that work at that particular moment. I was exaggerating my own capacity, if you see what I mean. And I was exhausting myself and I was getting overwhelmed. Yeah. So I was not looking after myself well enough. I had not done enough healing in terms of just accumulating enough positive emotion, enough nourishment for myself. I was not good enough at, really taking the decision to look out for myself and then start to look after others. And it just needed, this whole Bodhisattva ideal aspiration kind of thing needed to be grounded in reality, if you see what I mean. It did. And so I needed to look after myself first and then look after others. And I was thinking today when I was reworking my talk that it's a bit like, you're traveling with your child on an airplane and the oxygen masks come down and you've got to do yourself first before you put it on the child. So it's a bit like that, you just got to look after yourself first before you're really fully capable and able to look after others. So anyway, that simile worked for me. So, and it's difficult, I think, to know what is enough. It's difficult to know, you know, what you're capable of or when it's too much. And I think you probably only learn by trying and through trial and error. And, just really getting the feedback of yourself or of being fed back by others that actually I think you're doing a bit too much. And also just noticing how particular conditions bringing out negative states, so just working with conditions, working with negative states, and just understanding the relationship between them much better, so doing that kind of work for much longer. And also, you know, resting when you're exhausted, resting, you know, really knowing, noticing I'm exhausted, taking that rest, taking the space when you're overwhelmed. It sounds very simple, but often I think we don't look after each other well enough, if you see what I mean. And there is no shame in that, but and it's also not selfish. You really do need to look after yourself. You really do. Yeah. So I think initially I misinterpreted the Bodhisattva ideal by thinking that it was something I had to do on my own, and that's like a totally exhausting idea, isn't it, that you got to do it on your own. But I've learned since that it's not an individual thing. You're kind of joining in with others doing it, and it is a bit more like something that you could tune into, as it were. And there's a load of other people as well that are trying to do something good, and you can feel those combined forces at work. So, and also that this thing about me, I have to do this on my own, there is a separate me, is a total illusion, because things don't happen because I make them happen. Things arise in dependence on conditions, and I am only one of all these conditions that is taking place, if you see what I mean. I can influence a situation, but I cannot control the situation. So thinking that I could control that is like, it is a mistake, and it's exhausting to think that you control things, you see what I mean? So it's madness. I cannot save the world. Just, I cannot save the world. I cannot save all the beings. I know that with my head, but with my heart, I still want to believe it. I do want to believe it, and I believe it. I do believe it. Yeah. So an image that we use in our order that we saw on the shrine, it's not exactly the same, but we have an image for the order of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. You know that image? Mm-hmm. And each of these hands is responding to the world, is giving to the world what the world needs. And I love thinking about that, and I love sort of thinking about myself being one of the hands. But I also love thinking about that thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara being part of another thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, that being part of another thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. So we're all joining in to be a force for the good, and it just becomes much more light, it becomes much more spacious. It's not about me, it's about doing stuff together, if you see what I mean. So I do have a tendency to be idealist, and I take on these big projects and then I get exhausted, but I'm getting much better at finding out, you know, not embarking on these huge projects or stopping them early. I don't know, I think I'm a bit better at that. And Chandra Dasa was asking me yesterday in the question answer after my talk, he was asking whether when I felt exaggerating my own capacity to help others, when that sort of stopped, if you see what I mean, when I became more realistic. And I actually came up with an answer, mm-hmm. which I'm quite proud of in the heat of the moment. So this is about 10 years ago or so. I moved to Spain, and Amal has been there many times, a place called Ecodharma. And so it's a very idealistic place, I think. And so it's about eco-activism, it's about combining the Dharma with ecology, it's about living a simple life, not living off the grid, growing your own vegetables, carrying the water, and carrying your own gas bottles. And it's quite a lot of hard physical work, doing your own carpentry. I built the platform for our yurt, and living in really cold conditions. So I went there because, you know, I just really believed in that lifestyle. I thought that's going to be fantastic. I'm going to be this mountain yogi. I'm going to meditate. I'm going to get enlightened in the mountains. And then I'm going to accumulate all this knowledge about herbs, and I'm going to pass that on to the next generation, and I'm going to teach the Dharma.
Yeah, fantastic.
But then it just totally, totally went wrong. And it was the human factor. That situation just triggered all my buttons. All my reactivity came out. And I just had to acknowledge this is not working. So I came back and settled down in London. And the image for that that came up for me at the time was a bit like Icarus. You know this image of Icarus? It's like this mythological Greek figure, and he's got these wings, and he's attaching with wax to his body, so he's trying to kind of fly. That's his dream. So he flies to the sun, and the closer he comes to the sun, the wax starts to melt, his wings drop off, and he crashes down onto the earth. Well, that was me after having lived in the mountains, yeah? Just like a heap crashed onto the earth, and I was angry and frustrated. But having worked with all of that, I was just so liberated as well. Because it was like this really big ideal I had for myself, and it completely, completely fell apart. And then I could just start, and it just became much more real after that. Mm-hmm. So what actually happened from my pain about feeling isolated there, about my pain of not being to offer what I wanted to offer, what I felt I wanted to offer from not being able to connect to people, from feeling there is no friendships here, I started to get engaged with the West London Buddhist Center, and I started to become the Women Mitra convener, because actually that pain that I'd had about the lack of friendship, I just wanted to help others who felt that, and I wanted to befriend, especially, you know, I want to befriend the men as well, but it's especially because of my pain was to do with like a lack of female friendship, particularly. Just wanted to reach out to the women there. So that's what I started to do from there on. So that's some of that, a bit of my journey. It's still obviously totally continuing. It's totally continuing this journey. But I thought I could say a bit about bodhicitta, because I think, the relationship between bodhicitta and bodhisattva might not always be obvious. I thought I'd say a little bit about it. You could say this bodhisattva, enlightened being, is an embodiment of a principle that's called bodhicitta. So I'll tell you a bit about bodhicitta, okay? So bodhicitta is two parts, bodhi and citta. And bodhi, I've got bodhi in my name. And it's not a Buddha, but anyway, Buddha. So the word bodhi means awakened, and citta means heart, mind. So in Buddhism, there is no distinction between heart and mind. So it's just like it's the heart, and the heart is also the mind. And I was saying at this the weekend we had here, the weekend retreat, is like there's a lot of neurological activity in the heart, so there's no reason why it couldn't be a heart mind. And so it means it's the awakened heart, it's the heart's desire, you could say. It's the heart's longing for freedom. You could say it's the heart-mind oriented towards compassion. It's the awakened heart. So I could say a lot of names. I could say a lot of words, but it doesn't really mean much sometimes if you don't have that kind of heart, sort of felt response to it. So it's quite hard, I find, to explain what the bodhicitta is, because I can't explain it in words. I cannot. It can only point to something. Words can only point to something. So we're talking about concepts here, and it needs to point to something that is much more deeper, that comes from a much deeper level, a deeper space that needs to emerge, if you see what I mean. So a lot of these values in life, you can't touch them. They're intangible, like love or trust. So bodhicitta is, for me, bodhicitta is like that movement. It's the heart, for me, the heart's longing for freedom works quite well. It's sometimes even like a leaping of the heart. So you see somebody who is suffering in some sort of way, somebody with pain that you come across, and then your heart makes that kind of like, you know, a kind of leap, like a longing, like a reaching out, like, oh, could I alleviate that suffering? Oh, I wish I could help. You see, it's that. That kind of movement, which is very hard to describe in words, if you see what I mean. Yeah. So it's said that once this bodhicitta has arisen, once that kind of has manifested in your experience, that that is actually the real beginning of the spiritual path. I find that quite beautiful. So, but also, I just want to acknowledge that, yes, I can sit here and be really inspired, but sometimes I'm not. I'm just flat and uninspired, and I've got no idea what it's all about. And So I do think I go through these cycles of sometimes feeling very much connected from a heart level to this principle, and sometimes I just like feels more disconnected, cold. Yeah. So I think that I just need to acknowledge that that sometimes works like that. I think it's I go through these cycles. I suspect many people do, and it's a bit like I find the image of this flower that opens quite beautiful. So there is a flower that's growing, and as the sun comes up, it opens, and the night comes, and it closes down again. It's just this natural movement of the heart and opening and then closing, which you can't really force.
Yeah.
So, but you can, I think, train in the training that we do with all our Buddhist tools, training that heart to be, become more, a bit more open, or a bit open more often, that kind of thing. A bit like a muscle, maybe, instead of a flower, I don't know. So, you can train it to receive much more, and to be more open, and to listen, and to not contract when you're perceiving any kind of ego threats, if that says something to you. So I don't think that bodhicitta can be understood on the level of thinking alone. And that was the weird disconnect on writing the talk, that sometimes, so my head was kind of going, oh, I don't know, but my heart would still be very much convinced of it. It's a strange kind of disconnect that's happening there. So, a bodhicitta doesn't come from thinking about it. It needs to be embodied, and it needs to transcend thinking, and it needs to come from a place beyond thinking. Yeah. And in the Bodhicharavatara, which is a text by Shantideva, which is, I think, one of the most famous texts, which is about the path of the bodhisattva, it's written, there are two kinds of bodhicitta. And there's the bodhicitta as an aspiration, and there is a bodhicitta put into practice. So there's a big difference there. And the difference is, according to the text, it's like that between someone who wants to go travelling and someone who actually goes. Which is quite clear, isn't it? It's quite clear. And, you know, it's both necessary. You know, you've got to do your planning, you've got to do the wishing and the wanting, but you also got to actually go. Yeah, you've got to go. So I find that quite interesting. So this moving between concepts and beyond concept, from idea to reality, from thinking of an action to spontaneously acting. And I think this is like the playground of an aspiring bodhisattva. And I think I can say that I think most of us in this room are probably aspiring bodhisattvas, aren't we? Yeah? One person is not, that's good. So I'd like to say a bit about bodhicitta as the secret ingredient, the missing factor. So sometimes in my life when I feel something is lacking, it feels dry, I don't see the point, etc. If I remember this principle, bodhicitta, it somehow turns okay. And I just really don't know how this works, and it's really mysterious, but it seems to work like that. So I do think that sometimes we are getting involved in all kinds of concerns that are very much about our own world. We're getting very absorbed in anxiety and worry and fretting about this, that and the other. So for me, the image that works is you're kind of spinning yourself in by all these negative thoughts, and it becomes like a very isolated place to be in. And it's going to be very difficult from that place to reach out to others somehow. It just seems like it's like a barrier between you and the rest of the world. You don't feel connected, you might feel depressed, just you know, there is that lack of connection with the rest of the world there. And somehow just starting to think about other people suffering from the same thing. If you're depressed and you start to think about other people who were in the same situation, who were suffering, somehow just remembering that is like this starting motor of the whole engine. Somehow it just turns things around as in a miraculous way. I don't know how it works. I don't know how it works, but it does work. It does work like that. It just gets you out of this self-absorbed kind of little world, if you see what I mean. And an image I've been using on our retreat and also yesterday evening is just a bit like you're in a pit. Yeah, you're in a pit and you just can't see anything. You just can't see the world outside, and you've got to somehow get out of the pit. And just having these thoughts about other people suffering and connecting to other people will somehow give you that sense of a wider perspective. You can take a step back, you're getting less absorbed, there just seems to be a bit more space coming into the experience, and it just starts to kind of turn for the better, if that's an expression, I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So sometimes when we're not inspired, maybe, you know, very simply, just connect to the body, and connect to the heart, and just listen, or just imagine other people out there who might have the similar kind of problems as you do. And you're still wondering your own problems, you know, you're not suppressing them, you're not pushing them away, but you're just inviting the rest of the world in your own experience, as it were. So I also wanted to say somehow, in my notes, that flows from one thing to another, but somehow that this just listening, just being, just witnessing is also something that you could do. You don't always have to do a lot to be a bodhisattva or an aspiring bodhisattva. We sometimes have this idea that we need to act, do this, do that, get ourselves completely exhausted in all kinds of activity. Well, that might not be necessary, if you see what I mean, because sometimes it's just a much better option just to sit there and be quiet and just to listen to the sounds of the world, listen to the sounds of the suffering in the world as well. Just be open to that. So this is the function of receptivity. It's just ever so important. And another word, name for this bodhisattva of compassion is Guan Yin, and that literally means she who hears the cries of the world. Mm-hmm. And I find that quite a beautiful example. For me, it's just, sometimes it's just okay just to be. You're just listening and just witnessing. You don't have to always do something, if you see what I mean. Well, I think for me that's important. It's an important principle. So what I think, at least, is that the only sane response to encountering these cries of the world is this path of the bodhisattva. I think it's the only thing that, for me, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. And it's the only way that I can move from the confinements of my very narrow ego-based perspective to a wider perspective. And I also feel that you can't be happy. I can't be happy if I know other people aren't happy, if you see what I mean. I just find that it's an impossible idea. So I think it's important then, for me it's important to remember the bodhicitta. In the times that I don't feel inspired, I feel negative, I somehow need to remember that, the bodhicitta. And this is also from the Bodhicharyavatara. The bodhicitta is the only cure. Yeah. So this is actually my notes, it's not the bodhicitta. I'll read my quote now, I started on the wrong line. So, the bodhicitta. This is the moon of the mind, whose light banishes our darkness. This is the brilliant sun that burns off the mist of delusion. This is the essential butter from churning the milk of the Dharma. Yeah. I'll repeat that. This is the moon of the mind, whose light banishes our darkness. This is the brilliant sun that burns off the mist of delusion. This is the essential butter from churning the milk of the Dharma. Hmm? I love that. How are we doing for time? Just a quick check. Mm. Oh, how long have I got?
Oh, 15 minutes.
Okay. So I won't be able to take any questions if...
Up to you?
Yeah. Oh, I would like to talk a bit more.
Yeah?
Is that okay? Yeah? Okay. I just want to talk a bit about vows. So maybe you've heard of this Bodhisattva vow. I've got here a quote from Sangharakshita, who is the founder of the Trivatna Buddhist community. This expression of the bodhicitta through the individual, this individual expression, as it were, of the bodhicitta, this is what is known as the bodhisattva's vow. So that's, we've just been talking or thinking about the bodhicitta, so that is the expression through the individual. The vow, therefore, can be defined as the concrete, practical expression of the bodhicitta in the life and work of the individual bodhisattva. So I've just hoped that I've kind of shown there what the relationship is between the two, bodhicitta and bodhisattva. So I just wanted to say that these vows can be really strong, and it's important to examine our motivation before we can take a vow of any kind. And I think, especially talking about myself, and I think in the course of the years I've been having to work quite a lot with purifying my own motivation, if you see what I mean. So there's all kinds of stuff that can come up in relation to this motivation. Like you might, you don't want to do it to look good in the eyes of others, yeah, for instance. So yeah, not a good motivation. You also don't want to do this path because you're not good enough and you want to improve yourself. And also not a good motivation is because you don't feel happy with who you are, is also not a good motivation, if you see what I mean. Also not a good motivation is that you're going to accept your own faults and your own mistakes. And it really is about this heartfelt wish for the happiness of all beings. And I think sometimes these feelings of unworthiness or a lack of confidence, etc., are playing, are not having a good influence, if you see what I mean, on this path of wanting to embark on the path of the bodhisattva. So I won't go into this, I don't have time for that, but just to say, in our context, I think the closest that we come to vows is, for instance, in our mitra ceremonies. Some of you probably have done that. And some of us are order members, so we've taken particular vows in that context. And in when you become an order member, one of the lines of acceptance is for the benefits of all beings, I accept this ordination. So there is something around that. It's just, for me, it's really an important line of those four lines of acceptance. And I do think it's really important to be realistic about your own capacity and where you are before you're making a vow, any kind of vow, because it's just really painful if you disappoint yourself. If you're promising to do something that you're not able to do, it's just horrible feeling. So really being realistic about what you're promising to do is, I think, is really important. And I know for myself that I have taken vows prematurely, that I've not been able to live up, that I've been disappointing myself terribly. And but it did result in me becoming more careful with what I was promising in the future. Yeah. And in retrospect, I can feel compassion for myself because in the past, because I can see how things have arisen in dependence on conditions. And it's not like I chose to disappoint myself. It just happened. In dependence on conditions, there is no I in control there. Yeah, if you see what I mean. And I think this exaggerating of your own influence, thinking that you can be in control, I've said that before, apparently I find it important, is just leading to unnecessary emotional pain. So understanding that wisdom, which is a Buddhist teaching, more deeply, will hopefully lead to less of that emotional pain. And the only appropriate response is compassion, really. That is just the only appropriate response. Okay, so very briefly about perfections. I just wanted to say that this idea that you want, you know, like a bodhisattva is like a perfect being, I think that could just be one of my pitfalls, I think. Thinking about this bodhisattva as this perfect being, I don't think that's quite realistic, if you see what I mean. So I do think there's a lot of mileage into accepting things as they are, yourself as you are, just having compassion with what's going on in your own experience. So maybe there is a lack of self-worth, but compassion, again, compassion is like the only sane response to that. Mm. Not beating yourself up, it's compassion that is appropriate there. So this expectation of doing it right and getting it perfect is probably best if you could drop it, if you possibly can. Because it's just quite unhelpful. It's just so unhelpful. You just have to keep practicing with the tools that you have, and the path will sort itself out, if you see what I mean. So you don't have to kind of think ahead about becoming this perfect being, because it's happening here right now. You know, this is where it's happening, yeah? So the only thing you actually need to do is work with the tools that you have. It sounds simple, and I think it is, actually. It's really simple. So this bodhisattva as a hero of perfection, I don't think that's very helpful. And I had this dream a few months before I was ordained about being the bodhisattva of imperfection. And I thought that was really... I thought that was a significant dream for me, because I did think that... I mean, I'm still not quite there, not at all, but I'm sort of coming to terms a bit more with the state of affairs and this sort of process that is called Yashobodhi now. So how to measure the effects on that you have on the world? How do you measure that? No idea. No idea. You just don't know. Often you just really don't know. You were saying to me, I'd said something to you and that was important to you 2 years ago. Didn't have any memory of that. It's fantastic, isn't it? You could just do something today, would have a beautiful effect on someone. You might not know about it. I might not have met you again. You might not have said it to me. So that's happening all the time in our lives. You're doing something, it has a really beneficial effect on another human being. You just don't know. You don't know the effect of your actions. So you don't have to become famous. You don't have to be a world famous bodhisattva. Not necessary. Yeah? So I just wanted to do this. Give this a quote from Mrs. Middlemarch. This is like my absolute favorite quote of the Victorian literature. So it's a book called Middlemarch by George Eliot. And this is towards the end of the book. And the protagonist is a woman called Dorothea, and she has a lot of really beautiful plans about all kinds of charitable acts that she's going to do with her life. She's going to build all these cottages, this, that, and the other. She's got huge plans. She's constantly busy at it. It's not happening. It's not happening the way that she envisaged it. And it's only, yeah, so it's a bit disappointing for her. Mm-hmm. So the book, George Eliot's writing about her. But the effect of her being on those around her was incalculably diffusive. For the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts. And that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs. I just find that so good. So we don't have to become famous, you know, we can have a massive effect, yeah? So I'll just conclude here. I've got a few more things to say. This is again from the Bodhicharapatara, and this is an aspiration again. May I be the doctor and the nurse for all beings until the world is cured. May I be the food for the hungry and wealth for the poor. May I be protector for the unprotected, a guide for the lost, and a boat to the other shore. May I be a lamp for those who need light, and a bed for those who need rest. May I be a servant to all beings. So that is how it's formulated in the Bodhicharapatara. So it's been my personal quest, and it's still a personal quest. I'm not there at all. But how to come up with an appropriate response to what life presents to me. So how do I do that? How do I respond to life? How does that work? And sometimes I feel I'm getting it slightly right, and sometimes I'm not getting it right, and I've got to try again. Yeah. So this is for me a lifelong quest. And so this whole life is like a dance of receiving and giving of receiving and giving. It's not like I've got to give all the time. Mm-hmm. I've got to just sit and receive, and then when I feel I'm ready. I just start giving again. You see what I mean? It's beautiful dance in that sense. And I always wanted as a child to become this Renaissance woman, you know, it's the Latin word for this homo universalis. So it's just Leonardo da Vinci was one thing. So they could just like speak 100 languages, where they could paint, and they knew how to build a car, kind of. And you know, they're just but that for me, that early wish to become that. It's like a way to give to the world somehow, or to express what you can do with your talents in the world that is around you somehow. That is a good match. And ever since I had my first retreat, I felt, or before that, but especially after my first retreat, I felt my life didn't really fit around me anymore somehow. And I had to make these adjustments in order to make it a better fit. I always kind of call it like a haute couture garment. So instead of this, you know, short bought kind of thing that's kind of totally wobbly and wrong. But anyway, never mind. So I've made these bigger and smaller adjustments to my life after that. And it's still not a perfect fit, not by all means, but it's just, it does fit better, but it's not perfect. And it doesn't have to be perfect. It really does not. It's just exactly how it is. And, I don't know. I don't know what the right response is to life, but maybe it's just offering your life. Maybe that's it. That's it. Well, that's it. That's it. Mm. Mm.